From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Back in December, when we put together our Breaking News Consumer Handbook Election Polling Edition, we warned against taking general election polls too seriously too early. A quick rehash. 1. Pay attention to which firm produced the poll. The 5 big ones that determine eligibility for the upcoming debates, which include the CBS New York Times poll and Fox News, those employ live interviews and are therefore more reliable, but they're also less frequent. In their absence, news outlets often draw upon automated and internet polls, which are much more likely to be untested, historically inaccurate, and on occasion, fake. Look at a bunch of polls and outlets that aggregate them because trends and averages matter most. With the conventions a month behind us, those trends suggest that Donald Trump's incendiary populism is increasingly unpopular. As CNN's Brianna Keller recently pointed out to Trump Organization lawyer Michael Cohen following the replacement of the campaign chief 2.5 months before Election Day.
You say it's not a shakeup, but you guys are down. And it makes sense that there would
polls. Says who?
Most of them. All of them?
Says who?
Polls. I just told you I answered your question.
Okay. Which polls?
All of them.
This exchange was duly noted by the quants over at 538.com, Nate Silver's data journalism platform, where consolidating polling data is what they do. Senior political writer Harry Enten joins us once again to explain what all of them means and what it doesn't. Harry?
Well, what we know from the past is that candidates who are leading by the margin which Hillary Clinton leads right now usually win. And in fact, no one this far after the conventions has actually lost since Harry Truman beat Thomas Dewey in 1948, and the polling technology back then was different. But the idea that someone can't close a margin that's 6.5 percentage points isn't borne out in the past. You can look at the 1980 campaign, for example, where Ronald Reagan was basically tied with Jimmy Carter at this point and ended up winning by nearly 10 percentage points on Election Day. So these margins can close.
One way they can close is if there's some sort of scandal, some sort of October surprise that causes Hillary Clinton's campaign to implode. People are looking over their shoulders at the FBI's release of emails over the next WikiLeaks disclosure. Is that the kind of event that can cause the gap to close very quickly? Any historical precedent for that?
I would point to, say, 1968.
Good evening, my fellow Americans.
When Lyndon Johnson was basically trying to end the bombings in Vietnam and trying to create the original October surprise.
I speak to you this evening about very important developments in our search for peace in Vietnam.
As the Vietnam position of the Democratic Party became more dovish, there was a closing of the polls. And I think Donald Trump is hoping something similar will happen this year. Maybe it's a WikiLeaks, maybe it's the debate, but usually most single events don't have an impact. And this is why I often warn of be wary of the outlier and be careful of any momentary trend that you think you see in the polls. See if that trend still exists in a week or two. Remember in 2012, for example, we saw after the first debate, Romney come back in the polls and everyone was screaming, oh my God, this election's a toss-up.
New polls show a race completely up for grabs.
New ABC Washington Post poll shows the race is now at a dead heat.
But in fact, 2-3 weeks later, we ended up pretty much exactly where we were pre-debates, which was Obama clearly leading.
National polls seem to have the benefit of taking the temperature of the whole electorate. But you advise against putting too much stock in national polls. Why?
There are two reasons why. Number one, obviously, the winner wins by winning the Electoral College. So you need to know who's winning in the individual states. Though I should say, if someone's leading by, say, 6.5 points nationally, they're probably going to win the Electoral College many more times than not. But, you know, who knows? Stranger things have happened. The other reason why is that we know historically, for whatever reason, the state polls, when aggregated together, in fact, give us a more accurate read of the election than the national polls do. Again, we can look back at 2012, for example. On Election Day, when the state poll showed an overwhelming Electoral College victory for Barack Obama and the national poll showed a tighter Obama lead, it was the state polls that ended up being correct.
So in our political environment, 42 of the state results are preordained. They're going to be red or blue, and we know that already. This brings us to the swing states. Is that what 538 does? Focus entirely on those swing states?
Even if we believe that 40 or 42 of the states already preordained, we can't be sure of that, especially in this election cycle where Donald Trump has upset the apple cart so many different ways. We are looking at all of the state polls. We're aggregating them together. And from those state polls, we know whether or not the swing states are still the swing states. And we're then able to project out what's the chance that Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton is going to be able to win this election based upon mostly the state polling.
National and aggregated state polling results usually conform to the popular vote. The Electoral College and the popular vote are usually the same, but not always?
Not always. Even a young lad like myself remembers in 2000, for instance, when the state polling actually suggested that Al Gore was probably going to win. It was going to be a very tight race, though. And then the national poll suggested George W. Bush was going to win easily, and that was a case in which the state polls, again, were correct mostly while the national polls weren't, but the final result showed that the national winner didn't line up with the winner of the Electoral College. And that's why it's so important to look at the state polls, because in a lot of the red states, Donald Trump still leads in the states that Mitt Romney won, but by a smaller margin. And that has allowed the national polls perhaps to show a wider lead for Hillary Clinton because she's doing better in those red states, but she's not running up the margin as much in the swing states, which is where this election will ultimately be decided.
We're trying to understand how to evaluate polling results as they're reported in the press. Some polls measure the showdown between the Democratic and Republican nominees. Others include the Green Party and the Libertarians. What do we do?
Well, we are looking at the polls that include all of the party candidates because right now there is, in fact, a difference between the polls that include Gary Johnson, Jill Stein, and those that don't. Donald Trump closes the margin a little bit on Hillary Clinton when you include all of the candidates. It's a little bit more than a percentage point. Now, that doesn't matter so much right now as Hillary Clinton holds a very large lead, but if the race gets closer, it could get very interesting because you might get a signal from the polls that don't include Johnson and Stein that isn't confirmed by the polls that do.
I read a recent piece, I think probably by you, and the most fascinating passage in it concerned the difference between closeness and certainty. We were constantly seeing this formulation at 538 and the New York Times that there is an 88 or 90% probability that Clinton will prevail, but you're saying that large gaps such as we're seeing now between the candidates, may suggest volatility more than they suggest certainty.
If you look at 2012, Obama had a very steady lead. This time around, remember right after the Republican convention, for instance, Donald Trump closed the gap significantly with Hillary Clinton, even led in some polls. So that's one thing. She is still most likely going to win, but some days she leads by 7 or 8. Where, in fact, a month ago, that lead was in the low single digits. Right after the conventions, it might have been in the high single digits. And what the model does is it takes that into account and says, you know what, this race may not be as over as the margin suggests it is.
So even though Obama had only a 2% lead the day before Election Day in 2012, the Obamas would have been better advised to fit the Lincoln bedroom for drapes than the Clintons are today, even with this yawning 7% gap between her and Trump.
Right. Barack Obama's polls were very consistent. People's votes were locked in. That's not as much the case this time around. There are a lot more undecideds, which gives Donald Trump an opening. It may be a small opening that might allow him to climb back into this race and potentially win.
Harry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Harry Enten is the senior political writer at 538.com. You can find the Breaking News Consumer Handbook Election Polling Edition Part 2 at our website, onthemedia.org.
Coming up, a dust-up over trigger warnings and safe spaces, and who's really being coddled on campus?
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. You've probably heard some version of the recurring brouhaha over trigger warnings, safe spaces, and political correctness on college campuses.
Today's college kids are so coddled, so protected, they're the equivalent of a 13-year-old from a century ago. Why give them freedom of any kind?
You're fighting for the right to be a pussy and not hear opinions that you don't like!
The latest iteration of this debate unfolded last week after a letter sent to incoming freshmen at the University of Chicago had this to say, quote, "We do not support so-called trigger warnings. We do not cancel invited speakers because their topics might prove controversial. And we do not condone the creation of intellectual safe spaces where individuals can retreat from ideas and perspectives at odds with their own." The letter sparked glee from some, outrage from others, and to that, UChicago has since said, we've been misinterpreted. However, the underlying issue remains. Is free expression on college campuses being stifled by tools like trigger warnings and safe spaces? Cameron Okeke graduated from the University of Chicago in 2015. He wrote a piece this week in Vox titled, "I'm a Black UChicago Graduate. Safe spaces got me through college." As the title suggests, he wrote in response to that welcome letter to his alma mater's incoming class.
I was upset when I first read it. My time at the University of Chicago, I hadn't really encountered places where I could run away from people's perspectives. But I could find places where people didn't question who I was. And I thought that's a very different type of safe space. And so that kind of led me to write the piece.
So let's talk about the unsafe environment that the safe space provides a sanctuary from.
So the University of Chicago has been under Title IX investigation for a while now. There has been task force, dialogue after dialogue, but the fact still remains there's been a long history of ignoring marginalized populations. There has been racist parties. There have been incidents of racist costumes. There have been the creation of this place called the Chicago Politically Incorrect, which included a plethora of hateful, threatening, disdainful speech about students, like personally attacking students. And that doesn't even speak to the amount of sexual assault mishandlings that have happened over the last couple years. And so the climate is one in which if you're a person of color or if you are a woman or basically if you're a person who doesn't have a privileged identity, you don't have the type of institutional support or backing that other students may have.
Now, you found a safe space, which turned out to be the Office of Multicultural Affairs.
And when I was there, you know, it wasn't that I wasn't challenged and no one would take my ideas and kind of run them through the intellectual wringer, but I was never being pestered by other students to explain what it means to be Black or being tested in such a way to see if I'm actually fit the UChicago
profile.
Profile, yes.
You didn't fit the profile?
Not at all. I mean, I was a first-generation student born in the South Side of Chicago, and I'm Black. So it was one of those situations where people were like, oh, what are you doing here? Is it affirmative action? I can't tell you how many questions I fielded about Black culture, about why Black people don't value education, why is the South Side of Chicago dangerous, blah, 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 blah. And in OMSA, if they want to answer these questions, they would ask them in a respectful manner. They didn't assume or demand an answer from me as if I was only there to be the diversity for them. They cared about me as a person. And I think that having that type of space made me more willing to offer up my perspective and actually exercise my speech.
You've made the point that trigger warnings and safe spaces actually are conducive to academic freedom.
We have seen time and time again that diversity for diversity's sake is not enough. We can't just have people of color in a room. We can't just have women in a room and expect them to speak. Freedom of speech is not something that has ever been equally accessible in our nation. We have to do work for that. And I think that part of what trigger warnings and safe spaces do, they do the work to give people a way to step away from the conversation so they can reenter it when they feel like they can. And it gives people the freedom to engage when they need to and then also step away when they can't. And I think that that enriches the conversation as opposed to undermining it, because it just doesn't work trying to force people into a conversation that they don't want to have.
Critics call that coddling. Your generation is just so sensitive.
Mm. We are sensitive. I honestly think that the critics who claim that we can't take the realness of the real world don't seem to understand that being born black, being born a woman, being born whatever way you are that doesn't fit into the mainstream norm means your life is already hard. I was already living in the real world before I came to the University of Chicago. And I don't ask my university to coddle me any more than I guess any other student would ask them to accommodate their needs, especially given the fact that universities have spent the larger part of their history catering to and pandering to one demographic of people. And so I think that there is a certain degree in which we should be able to ask for the university to change the way it functions to accommodate the diversity it claims that it wants.
You have to assume that the U of Chicago sent this letter because administrators think that there is a stifling of expression and that it's part of a nationwide trend. Mm-hmm. Do you see that happening?
I see it happening, but I don't see it happening because of the trigger warnings or because of safe spaces. We are living in what I think would be an unprecedented political climate. But the university shouldn't use this in their welcoming letter. If they want to have a conversation about this, fine. That'd be great. But a welcoming letter for new high school graduates who are excited to be in this type of intellectually stimulating, amazing environment is not the time to tell them what you do and don't condone. It's a time to welcome them and say that we as a university, we support diversity, we care about people, we're doing our best. That's what a welcome letter should do. They tried to curb the trend, but they didn't do anything else but fan the flames.
Cameron, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cameron Okeke graduated from the University of Chicago in 2015. He's currently earning a master's in bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. His recent piece in Vox is called "I'm a Black U Chicago Graduate. Safe Spaces Got Me Through College." Okeke argues that trigger warnings can help students find their voice in a classroom. That's why Cornell philosophy prof Kate Mann uses them.
A trigger warning is, for me, as simple as a one-sentence heads up in an email to students saying this week's reading contains maybe a graphic description of a sexual assault or a description of active military combat, something along those lines. And I should add, I teach feminist philosophy, so a lot of the material that I cover is on misogyny and topics like mass rape during genocide. So a lot of people who teach wouldn't have any reason to use them. Allowing students who have the relevant sensitivities to prepare themselves for those sorts of discussions.
You expect in a class of 200 there might be some traumatized people in there. Maybe they shouldn't be taking that class.
The current evidence suggests that perhaps as many as 1 in 5 students will be sexually assaulted while on campus. So we would be potentially ruling out a lot of people from discussions of sexual assault who might have the most reason to engage in them if they didn't feel comfortable coming into class ready to confront these harrowing topics. People have real bodies, real memories, real histories. People don't come into university necessarily shiny and new. Not everyone is able to dive into every topic with complete equanimity. But that doesn't mean we can't talk about it. We have to.
And you haven't noticed people skipping out from your classes with a note from their doctor?
No, that just hasn't come up. The key really is to think about trigger warnings as preparation for people to engage rationally, calmly, and fully with the material. They're not designed to foster avoidance. The people who I happen to know in my classes have had the relevant traumatic experiences, sometimes recently, will often thank me not just for providing trigger warnings, but for bringing up subjects that they want discussed because they've been there.
Hmm. Obviously, you've heard the opponents of trigger warnings suggest that this is just more coddling for a generation that's already been coddled practically into paralysis. I just wonder whether by saying, take care over this section you're going to do. You're putting red lines and exclamation points. You just give a reason for students to be censorious.
I mean, the reason I give trigger warnings is I'm teaching material that traditionally people have been protected from in the academy. There is very little discussion, say, of misogyny and sexual assault in philosophy until feminist philosophers began to introduce those topics. So it's not obvious to me that this is really about coddling so much as that's an expression of resentment to extending basic consideration and kindness to people when, in fact, new and more challenging topics are under discussion.
The weird thing is that the banner of academic freedom has been picked up by both sides of this discussion.
Yeah.
What I see is the creation of an environment where it is the professors that are being curtailed in their speech.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people who historically have been very privileged are feeling unfree because members of historically subordinated groups are freer to morally criticize their statements.
Professors want to be safe too.
Yeah, I think there's a fair amount of wanting to be coddled from moral criticisms that hurt, but that's what we have to learn to do. We have to learn to sometimes think, you know what, I put that badly, I feel ashamed, now I have to pick my head up, apologize, and keep teaching.
Can you see a scenario in which trigger warnings could narrow academic freedom?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to be very careful about the possibility of trigger warnings becoming mandatory and it being top down on the part of the administration. That would clearly infringe on academic freedom, and I would be the first to be up in arms about it. What I am in favor of is student-led, bottom-up requests for trigger warnings.
You want the kids to run the university?
I want my students, personally, to be comfortable challenging me, and I think that's hard. I know how hard it is to challenge authority figures of any kind, and I do want students to be able, in a respectful, civil way, to say, actually, that was a really problematic way to approach this material, because that's what it means to have an egalitarian approach to education.
And is that automatically a good thing?
There's certainly differences in expertise. I'm not saying that I don't have intellectual authority in lots of ways in the classroom, because that's why I'm there. But there's a difference between intellectual authority and moral authority. And in some ways, students of mine who are not white, say, will have moral and political authority with respect to issues of race, and I should be listening.
Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Kate Mann teaches philosophy at Cornell. Jeffrey Stone is a professor of law at the University of Chicago, where he specializes in the First Amendment. He's helped stake out the university's position on free speech and says that that letter sent to freshmen that sparked this whole debate has been widely misread. He says the university is fine with both trigger warnings and safe spaces, as long as the former isn't mandatory or the latter exclusive.
The letter, which was written by the dean of students in the college, was basically meant to suggest that trigger warnings and safe spaces are both problematic concepts in an institution committed to academic freedom and to a robust political discourse. I think they've been misconstrued as suggesting that trigger warnings should be prohibited, even if faculty members wish to offer them, and that the idea of safe spaces, which is a very ambiguous term, in general is inappropriate, which is not at all what the letter said.
Yeah, that's sure not what he said, though. He said, we don't support trigger warnings. We don't condone the creation of intellectual safe spaces. So condone means the college is withholding its blessing from the creation of these safe spaces and that they don't support trigger warnings.
It's saying it doesn't encourage them, but it's up to the individual faculty member. It's a short letter addressed to entering students. It was not meant to be this huge public issue. As I've said before, I think this is much ado about nothing. I don't in any way begrudge the discussion of these kinds of questions. Having discussions about trigger warnings and about safe spaces and about certainly academic freedom, those are great issues. But coming back over and over again to the letter, which is written by a dean of students, not by the university president, not by a faculty committee, is just taking it way out of proportion.
You've written about how freedom of expression in American universities has kind of seesawed for centuries. Could you give us a brief history?
Sure. In the early 19th century and before that, universities were places in which the leaders of the institution would dictate, based on a principle of doctrinal moralism, what ideas could and could not be expressed. During the 1820s and 30s and 40s, during the debates over slavery, there were faculty members and students in the North who were disciplined or fired because of their defense of slavery, and there were faculty members in the South who were fired because of their criticism of slavery. It was during the era of Darwin and the dispute over creationism that universities, for the first time, began to talk seriously about freedom of expression, the quest for truth, and not to be bound by conventional wisdom. But even then, the issues continued to roil. During World War I, universities disciplined students and faculty members who raised questions about the legitimacy of the war. During the McCarthy era, of course, universities across the country basically banned any student or faculty member who was seen in any way as sympathetic to communism. During the Vietnam era, there were strong disputes about the appropriateness of dissent on campuses. So this has been an ongoing issue from all of our history. But increasingly over time, universities have come to accept the principle that for them to meet their responsibilities, faculty and students alike need to be able to express their views without having some senior officials determining what ideas are or are not permissible.
So how would you characterize the state of academic freedom now?
Well, I would say that, once again, it is under serious challenge. It's different from many of the prior episodes. Historically, the students were always the champions of academic freedom and of their own free speech. In this instance, ironically, it is the students who are the primary forces calling for censorship. The other difference is that traditionally it tended to be political conservatives who favored censorship. And now, interestingly, it's political conservatives who are robustly defending the freedom of speech. Liberals have always been the champions of free speech, both nationally and in universities, are divided. There are the sort of traditional liberals, like myself, who strongly believe in academic freedom. And there are others who basically say, well, even more important than free speech and academic freedom is ensuring that individuals who feel marginalized or alienated are protected from that environment, and therefore free speech should be confined.
This week we spoke to a UChicago grad who sees trigger warnings and safe spaces as essential to creating a campus climate in which all people feel free to express themselves.
Well, the key meaning of a safe space is that students can get together with other students with similar backgrounds and experiences and share their experiences with one another, learn from one another, feel safe in their conversations with each other, make plans, invite speakers. All colleges and universities have endless student organizations supported by the universities designed to enable them to do that. That's what, in my view, a safe space should be understood to be.
And Cameron Okeke, the University of Chicago grad that we spoke to, said that the safe space for him was the multicultural center where people of all different backgrounds got together without having to be the representative of a community that the majority of students wouldn't likely encounter. In other words, a place where they could have a freer expression without constantly trying to justify their own presence.
Sure, and that's a good idea, and they exist all over the place.
And that's all he's supporting, and maybe this is just an argument over definitions?
That's partly what I've been trying to say, is if safe space means a physical location that is earmarked only for people of a certain background, and only people of that background are allowed to enter some particular permanent space, that's a different issue. The reality is it's critical for students to have an opportunity to congregate with other students with similar experiences and to work things out themselves. And that exists all over universities, as it should.
But you do think that academic freedom is under threat?
The issues about academic freedom are about canceling speakers, intimidating students and faculty from saying things, demanding that the university punish students for saying things that other students don't like. That's the threat. It's not about trigger warnings, frankly, and safe spaces. It's about the effort to exclude from universities the expression of ideas that some students disagree with. That's the threat to academic freedom. And it is as serious a threat as we've seen in the last 40 years. And social media, by the way, makes it far worse than it ever was before. Because it used to be that if a faculty member or a student said something that was controversial, you could have an argument, you could have a debate, you can say things that, you know, were provocative. Today, those statements wind up on social media, and for the rest of your life, people can find it, look it up, and take it out of context. And we're seeing real chilling effect on the willingness of students and faculty to speak openly, to speak candidly, to speak courageously. That's not a healthy thing for academic freedom.
Can you give an example so that listeners will know the sort of thing you're talking about?
At one college, a group of students chalked on the sidewalk Trump in 2016. And other students demanded that the students who had done that be disciplined because the message Trump in 2016 made them feel unsafe. At another institution, indeed at many institutions, students learning that a particular speaker had been invited to the campus insisted that the university withdraw the invitation, and to avoid controversy, the university acquiesced. In other situations, the speaker comes to campus and students and others disrupt the event, yelling and screaming and so on, to the point where the event is canceled. Those are just common occurrences these days, and they're not consistent with what universities should aspire to.
The president of the Evergreen State College, George Bridges, wrote in the Seattle Times this week, "Colleges and universities must change as the society changes, and unlike 10 to 20 years ago, schools must now acknowledge and address issues that they have largely ignored in the past: sexual violence on campus, its effect on student victims, the impact of war experiences on veterans returning to college, and what's more, there's a real effort by colleges to recruit more diverse student populations, people who weren't there before, low-income students, people of color, people with disabilities, transgender people. These are new times that may call for new measures."
I agree completely with that, but it does not call for censorship. The mission of a university is to empower students, to make them effective, to teach them how to address things that are offensive and problematic and challenging so they can persuade other people that they are right. The mission of a university is not to shield students, because the world will not shield them.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Jeffrey Stone is professor of law at the University of Chicago, where he specializes in the First Amendment.
And it's no coincidence, of course, that the supposedly coddled students that demand trigger warnings and safe spaces also happen to be, you guessed it, millennials. If you don't know one personally, you've certainly heard of their kind. They're irreligious and worship only the meme. Whatever their parents embraced as fundamental to a stable lifestyle, they reject. They have no respect for what previous generations have built. They're Snapchatting themselves stupid, embracing the sharing economy so much that the Fortune 500 are doomed, and they go to an artisanal dentist. Anyway, so the media would have us believe.
Forget buying a TV, car, or even a house. Millennials would rather spend money on touring Southeast Asia, going skydiving, or rocking out at music festivals than showing off what they're up to in pictures.
So many millennials, they just don't buy the idea of going to a bank and doing all the paperwork and dealing with a teller. They've been Uberized.
Cereal sales could be in jeopardy because millennials don't like to wash dishes.
Laura Marsh is a story editor at The New Republic, and her recent piece, The Myth of the Millennial as Cultural Rebel, challenges the stereotypes. Laura, welcome back to OTM.
Hi.
So I listed some of the myths surrounding millennials. What's on your top three?
The millennials are killing the housing market, millennials are killing car ownership, and that millennials are killing the napkin industry.
The napkin industry?
In March, there was an article by Business Insider with the headline, "Millennials are killing the napkin industry." It reports that sales of napkins are down, but sales of paper towels remain the same. And that's because millennials find it too much work to buy paper napkins and that they have this laid-back lifestyle and they would rather buy paper towels.
Tell me about the coinage of millennials. Where did that come from?
The term millennials was coined by two kind of pop historians called Neil Howe and William Strauss. In 1987, they had preschool-aged children who they realized would turn 18 in the year 2000. So that's where they got the name from. And right around then, they started working out a theory of what millennials would be like, what kinds of character traits they would have, and from that, the kind of world that they believed this generation would build.
They were making their postulation based on what?
So I'm a millennial, and I wasn't even born in 1987. Their ideas about this came from a much bigger theory, which is best described as a wacky theory, about generational flux. So they believed that there were four types of generations and that they repeat in a pattern, the same pattern, over and over again throughout history. There are prophets, nomads, artists, and heroes. Their generation, the boomer generation, was a generation of prophets, and they believed that millennials, this generation they were looking forward to, would be a generation of heroes. I think what I object to is the idea that each generation has a kind of destiny. That's the idea that seeps into a lot of commentary about millennials, that we are hardwired to share and we don't like commitment and that we are coddled in some way and that we've always been that way.
Well, let's just stipulate for the purposes of this conversation that napkin usage and other attributes associated with the millennial generation are just so much baloney. Is there anything dangerous about this kind of glibness in our thinking and writing?
Yes, definitely. I think especially when we're talking about really important aspects of life, like work, housing, family, we can't accept the narrative that people are choosing not to join these institutions because they don't like them when there isn't evidence for that. Because these are things that need political solutions. If people can't buy houses and they're saddled with very high debts and they have to keep moving all the time, you can dismiss that by saying, oh, well, these young people like to move around and they don't want to own a home and they think that's just, you know, for the older generation. But you can also engage with it as a real problem and see it as something that is drawing more young people to candidates like Bernie Sanders who want to see more equality. I think that young people actually really want to see these problems addressed through our political system.
Is it possible that what, if anything, makes millennials different is that not just their technology, but their circumstances are radically different from some of the generations that preceded them in the sense that upward mobility is no longer a given? Is that the nub of the situation?
I do actually think it's that young people at the moment are the first generation in American history to have lower living standards than their parents. And they look at establishment politics and think, there's nothing for me here. I can't buy a house. I can't buy a car. I can't really afford to have kids. Home ownership, for instance, is at its lowest since 1968 right now. And that's largely because young people can't get into the housing market.
It's not like, ugh, I'm so off of owning my own car. It's like, I really can't even begin to think about a car payment.
Right.
I'm still in my parents' basement.
Right. And I think that especially car use is a very interesting example of the intersection of technology offering people some kind of alternative. You can rent a car by the hour using various car sharing services, and you might feel that that is actually a really great thing that you want to celebrate and that it connects with values that you have. Does that make you actually not want to buy a car? No, it probably just dovetails with the fact that you can't buy a car and this is a good solution. But I think what we see in reporting is the fact that people love car sharing so much that they don't want to buy a car. And I think that's a mischaracterization of this historically unique economic reality that young people find themselves in.
Is there something particularly about the millennials that lends itself to generalization and stereotype and these very broad sweeping conclusions?
Every generation gets bashed. Every time there's a new generation, the older generation has something disappointed to say. So I would like to invite boomers to start bashing us for the clothes we wear and the music we're listening to. I think that would be much more appropriate.
Laura, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Laura Marsh is a story editor at The New Republic and author of the recent piece, The Myth of the Millennial as Cultural Rebel.
Coming up, the music of your life, if you live in a swing state.
This is On the Media. No, I know you.
I got my potato.
On Radiolab.
And I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
Been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Sure, presidential campaigns are supposed to be about competing visions, ideas, and policies. But really, they're all about the feels. Candidates would like to win your mind, but they're much more interested in your viscera. And that requires stagecraft, moving soliloquies, forcefully delivered, artful lighting, evocative music. Eric Felton is managing editor of the Weekly Standard, where he recently explored the history of music in presidential campaigns. Eric, welcome to On the Media.
Brooke, how are you doing?
Good. So you trace the use of campaign music back to the earliest elections, from the campaign of William Henry Harrison against Martin Van Buren, the song Tippecanoe and Tyler Too.
As a general, William Henry Harrison had won a great victory at the Battle of Tippecanoe, so he was known as Tippecanoe, and his running mate was Tyler. So Tippecanoe and Tyler is Harrison and Tyler.
Oh, who has heard the great commotion, motion, motion all the country through? It is the ball a-rollin' on for Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. For Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. And with him will beat little Van, Van, Van is a used-up man. And with him will beat little Van.
It shows that Donald Trump wasn't the first to campaign by belittling his opponent. Long before there was little Marco, there was little Van. That's the president. It's the president of the United States, and he's being referred to as little Van, Van, Van is a used-up man.
And this campaign song tradition continues through the 19th century into the 20th. FDR had cozy songs like My Friend Franklin.
My friend Franklin steered us through some stormy skies. Mighty few can measure to his size.
And then there was the unfortunate song Click with Dick for Richard Nixon's 1960 campaign.
Come on and click with Dick, the one that none can lick. He's the man to lead the USA.
Can you imagine he actually lost that campaign? I don't know. With Tippecanoe and Tyler, too, you had this tradition of everybody singing along, and it becomes less of a sing-along as you get into the 20th century. So you have a transition to using pop tunes that are well-known and popular. FDR had Happy Days Are Here Again. Mm-hmm. Harry Truman, I'm Just Wild About Harry, where you have music performed by famous people. So, for example, in the John F. Kennedy campaign in 1960, Frank Sinatra had a big hit with High Hopes about a year before that, and he did a version specifically for John F. Kennedy where they kind of switched the lyrics around.
Everyone is voting for Jack because he's got what all the rest lack. Everyone wants to back Jack. Jack is on the right track because he's got...
Hillary Clinton this year is using Fight Song as one of her campaign rally tunes.
And Trump is using You Can't Always Get What You Want?
Yeah, and he's used Sympathy for the Devil as well. I know he likes the Rolling Stones, but really, are these the best choices one can come up with?
So why do you think the personalized campaign songs faded?
Well, what happened is you had an artistic transformational use of music and politics that came out of the 1968 Nixon campaign. To stop thinking about music as something for rallies and to start thinking about music in a cinematic way.
Give me an example.
Nixon hired a guy named Eugene Jones, who was a documentary filmmaker, to make a series of advertisements for television. And the first one was about the Democratic Convention of 68, which, of course, was rioting in Chicago and had been a big disaster for the Democratic Party. And while he was showing the still images from inside the convention hall, we hear a pep band playing a rah-rah version of "There'll Be a Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight," all good Americana rally music. And then we start seeing images of the rioting in the streets and police beating people. And when the images turned to the violent images, then the music shifted as well, much as it might in a horror picture. And the music became fractured and stuttered, and weird electronic overlay comes over the happy, rah-rah, cheering pep band music. It was meant to be disorienting and disturbing.
You also describe another Nixon ad called "The First Civil Right."
Yeah, this one is fabulous. The ad was all about how Nixon was going to be the law and order president. And there were all these images of violence in the streets, of rioting. And the music that was used was this surreal, creepy science fiction music. And what's particularly interesting about it is the music wasn't written for the ad. Instead, they got a disc from a production music house. Companies that record music to be used in television, low-budget movies, commercials. And the Nixon people found this disc that was sort of off-the-shelf music.
That you might use in the Twilight Zone.
Exactly. It really changed political advertising to having this sort of cinematic quality of using music not as a rah-rah tool, but as a way to signal emotional states. Ever since, a whole industry has grown up around providing music in political ads that sounds frightening and ominous, and it signals that the opponent is a bad guy.
But the musical cues of, say, the 60s, the scary organ chord that you might have heard in a soap opera would make you laugh today. So how did the tone change from the 80s to now?
Well, in the 80s, a lot of, you know, slasher flick, ominous, low rumbling synthesizers.
It's been 4 years, and Ronald Reagan still hasn't met even once with the leader of the Soviet Union.
That hard, heavy negative that sounds like the opponent is Freddy Krueger, that got used up to some extent. And so what's happened in the last decade has been a really interesting shift to what people in the business refer to as a soft negative, which is instead of making your opponent sound like he's scary and evil, you make your opponent sound like he's goofy, silly, stupid.
We went to a website called FirstCom, which is one of these off-the-shelf music publishing companies. There were songs called Negative Vibes, which sounds like this. And we also saw tracks like Loony Bin, which sounds like this. And that's kind of similar to Hillary Clinton's ad featuring Republicans mocking and criticizing Trump.
He is a con artist.
A phony.
Donald Trump is the know-nothing candidate.
Donald is a bully.
This is you get the point. But you wrote that more than the linear tracks that deliver a single emotion, you're particularly fascinated by what are called transitions.
You've got a 30-second spot, and you've got to do a lot in 30 seconds. And not only say that your opponent is a bad guy, but that your guy offers the solution. He's there to save the day. In the business, they'll talk about, well, that's an NP. It's a negative to positive. Or if you have two transitions, you might start with a positive transition to either evil-sounding music or stupid-sounding music for your opponent in the middle. And then you transition again at the end to something positive representing how your guy is going to save the day.
We have an example of that. We got it off of FirstCom, and it's called Compared to What's-His-Name. We'll play it for you. Talk us through it.
There we have the soaring anthem, something. Oh, no! What happened? I'm walking down a dark street alone, and then creeping back in.
There's hope.
Something hopeful. My name's Joe, and I approved this ad.
Now, I know you're not a political operative, but what kind of ad would you like to hear? And don't say, one full of really fact-filled policies or something like that. But I mean, what would appeal to you viscerally more than what you're hearing now?
You know, I'd like to hear an ad that featured Count Basie so I could just hear Count Basie and ignore the rest.
Any particular song?
In this political season, I would think of Joe Williams with Count Basie singing Every Day I've Got the Blues.
Eric, thank you very much.
Brooke, thank you.
Eric Felton is managing editor for the Weekly Standard.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Meera Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brennan. We had more help from Michael Lowinger, Sara Kari, and Noah Kernis. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.